The Task. It was 90 or 100 days after his entry into this elegant and distinguished household that Joseph, through the good offices of Sir Ankh Wen Nofer Netaru Hotep M. Per Amun, the dwarf, was given a task. It was a simple and rewarding one to carry out, if also a little burdensome and painful. He was lounging as usual in Potiphar's courtyard, willy-nilly waiting his hour, when the dwarf came running in his crumpled finery, with the felt cone of ointment cocked on his head, and announced in a whisper that he had something for him, a piece of good luck worth hearing, and leading to advancement. He had got it from Montcalm, who had said neither yes nor no, but simply suffered it. No, he was not to stand before Petitpré, not yet.
But hearken, O Sarsif, what you are to do, and how fortune smiles by the dwarf's contrivance, who has kept you in mind and brought it about. Today, at the 5th hour after midday, after their nap, the exalted parents from the upper story will come to the pleasure garden, and there, sheltered from sun and wind, will enjoy the coolness of the water and the peace of their great age. They love to sit there hand in hand in two chairs, alone in this hour of repose, save for a dumb waiter, who shall kneel in a corner with a salver of refreshment to comfort their spirits when they are tired from their peaceful sitting. You are to be the dumb waiter. Montcalm has commanded, or at least has not forbidden it, so you shall hold the salver of refreshment. But you must not budge as you kneel with your burden, not even to blink your eyes, else you might disturb their rest with your too much presentness. You must be entirely the dumb waiter, and like a figure of Ptah, for so are they used to have it. Only when the exalted brother-sister pair give sign of fatigue, then you must set yourself briskly in motion, still on your knees, moving very carefully, without stumbling or spilling anything on your clothing, and bear them the delicacies to be a cordial to them. When they are satisfied, then you must kneel backwards, swiftly, into your corner, and take care for your body, not to pant, or do aught to disturb or give sign of your presence, but to become at once the dumb waiter as before. Can you perform all that?
That I can, Joseph replied. Thanks, little Bess. All that will I do precisely as you have said, and even my eyes shall be as though glass, that I may look like an image, without presence more than the space of air which my body takes up. So nothing shall I be. But in all my stillness, my ears shall be open wide, unseen by them, the exalted brother-sister pair, when they speak before me, and name by their true names all the household matters, and I shall become master of them in my mind.
Very good, answered the dwarf. But conceive not that it will be simple to play for so long a space the dumb waiter and image of Ptah, or to haste to and fro upon your knees. It would be well for you to practice by yourself. The dish of refreshment will be dealt out to you by the scribe of the sideboard, not in the cook-house, but in the provision chamber of the house of the master. They will have it ready. Enter through the gate of the house into the entrance hall, and turn left by the stair toward the private room of trust, which is the bedchamber of Montcalm. Cross over diagonally, and open the door on the right, leading into a long corridor chamber full of provisions, so that you will see it is the store chamber. There you will find the scribe, who will give you all needful. That you must carry most heedfully across the garden to the summer-house, a little time before the appointed hour, that you may be already in your place when the exalted ones come. You are to kneel in your corner and hearken. When you hear them approaching, stir no eyelash more, or even scarcely breathe, until when they seem fatigued. Do you understand your service now?
Perfectly, Joseph replied. There was once a man's wife turned to a pillar of salt, because she looked back at the place of destruction. Such will I become in my corner and with my dish.
I know not the tale, said Netaru Hotep.
One day I will tell it to you, Joseph responded.
Pray do, O Sarsif, murmured the dwarf, in reward for the service which I have procured you. And repeat to me again the tale of the serpent in the tree, and how the pleasant one slew the unpleasant one, and the story of the far-seeing man and his ship like a chest, also the tale of the saved sacrifice, and the smooth one whom his mother made rough with skins, and later in the darkness knew the false bride?
Yea, replied Joseph,
Ours are good tales to hear. But now I go to practice running to and fro and up and down on my knees, noting the shadow on the clock, that I make myself fine in time for my service, and fetch the refreshments from the provision room, and perform all as you have said." He did accordingly, and when he thought himself perfect in running, he anointed and preened himself, put on his best clothes, the under apron skirt and the longer upper one that was transparent, tucked in the little shirt of darker, unbleached linen, and failed not to adorn breast and brow with garlands for the honor of the service to which he was called. Then he glanced at the sundial, in the open space surrounded by the master's house, the house of women, the cook-house, and the house of the servants, and went through the wall and the gate into the vestibule of Potiphar's dwelling, which had 7 doors of red wood with fine wide bands of decoration above them. The roof was supported by pillars, likewise of polished red wood, with stone bases and green capitals. The floor had a design of the heavens with its constellations, containing hundreds of figures: lion, hippopotamus, scorpion, serpent, goat, and bull stood in a circle with many figures royal and divine, and the ram, the ape, and the crowned falcon. Joseph crossed the hall, and by a door beneath the stair leading to the rooms above the rooms, he entered into the private room of trust, which was the nightly place of him above the house, Montcalm the steward. Joseph himself slept among the others on the floor in the servants' quarters. He looked curiously round at this private room. The bedstead was of elegant form, and rested on the claws of beasts. It was covered with skins, and the headboard had pictures of the gods that preside over man's sleep: misshapen Bess, and Epet, the pregnant hippopotamus. There were chests and stone washing things, lampstands, and a bucket for coal. He thought to what high position of trust he must rise here in Egypt to achieve such comforts as these. The thought brought him back to his service, and passing on, he came to the long provision chamber, so narrow that it needed no columns or supports to the roof. It ran the whole western length of the house, abutting not only on the dining room and reception hall, but on the third or western pillared hall. For besides this and the eastern one, there was another or northern hall. Of such rich and superfluous extent was the structure of Petipre's house. This long corridor, however, was, as the dwarf had said, lined with rows of shelves full of dishes and provisions: fruit, cakes, loaves of bread, boxes of spice, basins, beer skins, long-necked wine jugs in beautiful stands, with flowers to crown them. It was Kamat, the lanky scribe, whom Joseph encountered here, rummaging and reckoning among the stores with his reed pens behind his ear. "Here you are," said he, "greenhorn and know-nothing from the desert. You have made yourself fine indeed. Do you like it well in the land of men and of the gods? Yes, you are permitted to attend upon the exalted parents. I have it written upon my tables. Most like it was Shepsis Bess who procured you the service. How else would you have come by it? But he was anxious for your purchase, and screwed up your price to a fantastic sum. For how can you, who are a calf, have the value of an ox?" "Take heed to your words," Joseph mentally addressed him, "for one day I shall most certainly be set above you." But aloud he only said, "Be so good, Ka'ma'at, scholar of the bookhouse, who can read and write and make magic, as to give this unworthy petitioner the refreshment for Huia and Tuia, the venerable parents, that I may have it ready for them as dumb waiter in the hour of their exhaustion." "I must, I suppose," the scribe replied. "Your name is on my list, and the fool has brought it about. But I foresee you will spill the drink on the feet of the exalted pair, and then you will be taken off to be refreshed in your turn, until you are exhausted too, and he that gives it to you as well."
"Praise be to God, I foresee quite otherwise," Joseph replied.
"Do you indeed?" asked the lanky Kamat, blinking. "And after all, it is your affair, not mine. The refreshment is here, and is written down. The silver bowl, the little gold jug full of pomegranate juice, the little gilt cups, and 5 seashells with grapes, figs, dates, doom fruit, and little almond cakes. You will not steal or even nibble them?"
Joseph looked at him. "You will not, then," said Kamat, in some confusion. "So much the better for you. I merely asked, though I thought at once you would not like to have your ears and nose cut off. And, moreover, it is probably not your way. It is only," he went on, for Joseph was still silent, "because it is said that your former owners condemned you to the punishment of the well for certain shortcomings. I know not what. They may have been slight, and had to do not with matters of mine and thine, but with questions of wisdom. I cannot tell. And I have heard that the punishment availed to cleanse you, so that I only thought it right to put a warning question." "What am I saying?" he thought to himself. "Letting my tongue run on like that. I am a surprise to myself to find that I am irresistibly tempted to say all sorts of other things which should not be urgent, but are all the same. My office obliged me," he said, "to ask as I asked. It is my duty to assure myself of the honesty of a servant whom I do not know. And for my own sake I must do it too, for mine is the fault if any of the gear is lost. And I do not know you. Your origins are dark, at least insofar as it is dark in a well. Back of that they may be brighter, but the name they call you, Osasif, is it not? Seems in its last syllable to say you are a foundling from the rushes, and rowed round in a rush basket until a water-carrier drew you out. Such things come to pass now and then in the world. However, it is possible that your name has another meaning. I cannot tell. For in any case, I ask as I did because it was my duty, or if not absolutely my duty, then according to custom, and in a manner of speaking. For that is the way, and it is the tradition that one speaks thus to a young slave, as I spoke, and called him, as I did, a calf. I would not say you are actually and in fact a calf. How could that be? Rather I spoke but according as all speak. Nor do I actually expect and foresee that you will spill the pomegranate juice on the feet of the exalted parents. I only said so to be gruff, as is the custom in such cases, and spoke not the truth. Is it not a strange thing in the world that a man will hardly ever say what is his own, but that which he thinks others would say, and speaks after pattern and scroll? The dishes and what is left of the drink and food, Joseph said, I will bring back when my service is done. Good, Osasif. You can go straight through the door at the end of the storeroom instead of through the private room of trust. Then you will stand before the wall and the little gate in it, and beyond are the gardens and flowers, and you will see the pond and the smiling pleasure house. Joseph went out. Well, thought Kamat, left behind, how I did run on. God help me! What this Asiatic will think of me is past finding out. Had I but spoken as others do, and according to pattern and scroll. Instead of that, I felt all at once I must utter some uncommon truth, and gabbled quite against my will till my cheeks burned to think of it. By the aardvark, when he appears next before me, I will be as gruff with him as the best of them. Huia and Tuia. Joseph, meanwhile, had passed through the little gate in the ring wall, and found himself in Potiphar's garden, where the finest sycamore trees, date palms and doom palms, fig, pomegranate, and persia trees stood in rows on the greensward. Paths of red gravel ran across the grass. Half hidden among the trees, on a terraced mound, stood the gaily painted summer house, open toward the square basin of water bordered with papyrus reeds. On that green mirror swam bright-feathered ducks, and a light bark floated among the lotus blossoms. Joseph, with the dishes in his hands, mounted the steps to the kiosk. He was familiar with these elegant and aristocratic surroundings. Beyond the pond, the plane tree avenue was visible, leading to the double-towered gate on the south side of the ring wall, which gave direct entry to Potiphar's flourishing estate. The orchard, with its little runnels full of subsoil water, continued from the east edge of the pond, and then came the vineyards. And there were fields of the loveliest flowers on either side of the plane tree avenue and about the summer house on the mound. The carrying of all the soil needed to make the original desert blossom like the rose must have cost the children of the house of bondage much labor and sweat. The little building, quite open on the side next the pond, was flanked by white columns fluted in red, and furnished most charmingly. It was a dainty little retreat, adapted alike for solitary contemplation and enjoyment of the garden's loveliness, and for intimate intercourse, perhaps of two people, as the draught board on the little stand seemed to indicate. Gay paintings covered the white background of the walls, partly floral decorations consisting of garlands of cornflowers, yellow persia, grapevines, red poppies, and the white petals of the lotus flower, but partly, too, of spirited natural scenes. There was a troop of asses so lifelike that one thought to hear them bray, a frieze of high-chested geese, a green-eyed cat peering from among reeds, stalking cranes of the most delicate rust-red color, people slaughtering and carrying poultry and legs of beef in a sacrificial train. All this was so excellently carried out, so blithe and light-hearted and playfully mocking was the relation of the painter to his subject, so bold and faithful at once his hand, that involuntarily one would find oneself exclaiming, "Yes, yes, what a jolly cat! What a haughty crane!" And yet the whole seemed elevated into a sphere both more vivid and more austere, an aesthetic heaven, as it were, a celestial realm of good taste. Joseph, as he scanned these things, could give no name to that which nonetheless he perfectly well understood. This was culture which smiled down upon him from the walls, and Abram's late descendant, Jacob's youngest son, a little worldly as he was, leaning to youthful curiosity and youth's glorification of freedom, rejoiced in the sight, always with a silent reservation and a thought of the too spiritual-minded father who would have objected to all this picture-making. "It is charming to the last degree," he thought. "Admit it, old Israel, and revile not this achievement of Kempt's children, this taut and worldly and smiling effort in the very flower of good taste, for perhaps it might even be pleasing in the sight of God himself. I feel friendly toward it, and find it exquisite, despite the consciousness in my blood that probably the real and important thing is not to carry nature's handiwork into the high heaven of good taste, but rather the urgent need of care for God and the future."